And then I put a 3-year hitch in the 8th Air Force as a bomber crew member. And then I came back and started a fixed base operation in Talkeetna in early spring of 48.
And what particularly interested you in doing the high altitude flying?
Well, I had a pretty fair acquaintance with the Air Force high altitude operation. The old bombers used to fly up to 40,000 feet. And it just seemed to be my cup of tea. I mean, I like high places, and I enjoy a certain amount of leverage in the mountains, and it's just one of those things that I like.
For the people who know about such things, can you tell us what kind of aircraft you fly?
Well, the thing about mountain aircraft, I've tried most of the various types of airplanes. The single engine types are best, and the lighter the better. The bigger the engine, the better. And I've tried turbo supercharged airplanes. I've tried a turbo Beaver. But the problem is with the 650 horsepower turbo Beaver, you have a loss of power curve. And as you gain altitude, this PT6 does not develop. It's rated horsepower. It's not turbo supercharged. It's a it's a turbine engine, but not supercharged. Piston engines can be turbo supercharged and have some great advantages, but they're very expensive. Stock model airplanes, properly handled, can fly over the top of McKinley and not gross loaded. However, my choice, of course, is a 6-passenger 180H. Now, I haul under ideal conditions from the 10,000-foot level of gross sea level load. The way I do it is to take in consideration the density altitude, and I try to use the coolness of the early morning or the middle of the night when the snow condition is crusted. You must have some additional leverage because you are short of horsepower, 10 horsepower per every 1,000 feet or 1 inch of manifold pressure, which equals 10 horsepower. So naturally at 10,000 feet, you'll be short 100 horsepower. This you must take into consideration along with a myriad of other things, but if properly taken care of, you can haul gross loads at high altitudes. For the Air Force cold weather test, from the 12,000 foot elevation south face from McKinley, I haul gross loads under ideal conditions. Now, this don't mean downwind, and it don't mean in snow 10 feet deep. This means a crusted snow with a density altitude in your favor. I don't want to hold you up all night because I think I could, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, okay. What's the one that's pictured on the front cover of the book?
Oh, this is a stock model, finely tuned Super Cub. Now, this plane will fly with a stock model engine, non-supercharged, properly handled, with one passenger, with oxygen, over the top of McKinley. There's a regulation that requires oxygen above 12,000 feet. That's for the general public. If you know from the oxygen chamber test that you can go to 21,000 with no oxygen, that's a point in your favor. You probably need less oxygen. If you are a heavy smoker or have serious or minor internal problems, you will not be able to fly over the top of McKinley in a light aircraft. In a pressurized aircraft where the 737 is pressurized to 5,000 feet, why not? But where you get up there above 4/10 of the Earth's atmosphere, the air is extremely thin and the oxygen content is thin in proportion. And you will, unless you have a good tolerance, either black out, pass out, collapse, and And this is why they have a regulation for passengers and pilots, oxygen from 12,000 up.
You mentioned that at one time you had 8 aircraft. Do you have that many now?
I have 4 aircraft, 16 seats at the present time. And one is equipped with floats, one on retractable skis, and one on cross-country gear. These are 6-passenger Cessnas, and then one Super Cub for the real rough and tough areas and high altitudes and the short 200-foot sandbars and that type of thing.
What's, say, an average week like for you? How many hours do you spend flying?
Well, this summer we just put about 800 hours in 6 months, which don't truly sound like much hour-wise airline comparison, but when you load, unload, and maintain your own airplanes, I finally, in view of the liability for hiring additional pilots, the insurance to cover the mistakes of your possible employees, I decided to fly 4 or 5 airplanes myself, maintain all these airplanes in my new hangar, and that way, if I made any mistakes, at least they'd be my fault. Go ahead.
Do you fly 7 days a week usually?
Well, someone told me, they said, say, why don't we get you a pass to Europe? How about Mexico? How about Honolulu? Go to Maui or go to Australia, New Zealand? And I said, well, what do you mean? I need to go to all these places. I've been to most of them. And besides, I'm on a permanent vacation anyway. So I like it right in Tom Keaton.
Jim, why don't you tell us a little more about actually putting the book together? How long did it take you, and when was it finally all in publishable form?
Well, we started the book, I guess now it's been about just over 2 years, 2 years and 4 months, something of that sort. And we worked on it just about steady, except, of course, during the summer, late spring, when Don's tremendously busy with mountain climbers. I might mention here just very quickly that this last season he carried 37 climbing expeditions onto, I don't know, they all went on to McKinley down, or did they?
Yeah,
all
the
of
Alaska Range. Alaska Range.
Right. And anyone who knows, there's eight or ten men on each one of these groups, and possibly a ton to a ton and a half of gear per expedition. And you can easily see why we didn't do a whole lot of taping and writing in the late spring and summer. Most of what we did as far as the taping and work to get data built up for the book was done in the winter. But the book, as I say, took a little better than 2 years, and the actual writing of it, I guess, probably took the accumulation of the manuscript, the rough manuscript, I guess, took about a year. Oh, in about 14 months, I guess, in actual time. We had it down in that length of time. And then it took the rest of the time to accumulate the pictures, which was a tremendous job. That was much more difficult than writing the book for me, because it involved tremendous amounts of correspondence back and forth. We wrote for pictures to Lecco, Italy. Riccardo Cassin, the great Italian climber, contributed pictures to the book that had never been published before, and climbers all over the country and all over the world had submitted pictures. And as you know, these pictures require releases so that they can be published. They require caption material, names of people with the correct spelling, and it was just a seemingly a never-ending job to get these finally all accumulated, properly captioned, and submitted to Rand McNally. But and then my good wife typed 102,000 words of manuscript, and then that had to be triplicated and sent in to Rand McNally. So it was a major undertaking, but it was an experience I wouldn't have missed for anything.
Well, you and your wife both have full-time jobs. Was all this done on spare time?
Yeah, it was done in spare time. as was Don's part of it. And I regimented myself to writing approximately 4, sometimes 5 hours at night. And I would usually start about 8 o'clock and sort of avoid the traffic jam with the kids and the TV set, which was sometimes a little more than I could bear. But nonetheless, I started usually at 8 and I finished up 12:30, 1 o'clock most evenings, and then I'd write on the weekends, of course. But I got used to it after a while, and it was, if it hadn't been as interesting and as fascinating to me as it was, I doubt very seriously that I could have done it.
I think we have a question from a caller, Sean.
Yes, a caller called in would like to know Don's opinion of a comparison between a champ and a cub.
I'm sorry to say that I'm in favor of the Clark Y airfoil, the Super Cub. I've owned a fleet of various types of airplanes, including 140 horsepower champs, the Super Cubs from 65 horsepower to 180 horsepower special installation, and there's no comparison in high altitude performance. You have a different airfoil and too much profile drag in the Citabria Ronca type aircraft as compared with the Super Cub Piper. Go ahead.
Do you do all your own maintenance work on your plane?
I do most of it. I have an authorized inspector's rating and an airframe and power plant rating. And I enjoy tuning engines and working on aircraft. I have the license to overhaul engines. However, I'm too busy, and during long periods of time involved in other activities, you even forget how to read my commoters properly. So I either buy new airplanes, new engines, or get air power overhaul in Anchorage to do a precision job on my engines.
What about your wife? I can't imagine her living with you without getting involved in flying. Is she a pilot herself?
She flew around the world 7 times with Flying Tiger Airlines as a stewardess. She used to be on the Cannonball flights where 2 crews would fly a 1049G Constellation aircraft all the way around the world. And it'd take them 2 weeks to recover. Does she work in the operation? She raises 3 beautiful, smart kids. She bakes cookies. She runs radios, telephones. She alibis my lateness, which is sometimes unavoidable. She raises champion Alaska sunflowers in the beautiful garden, and she's quite busy. And we've been married 10 years, and on our scenario to the family reunion in Wyoming, that was the first break she had in 10 years.
We're running out of time here, Jim. We've got about 3 or 4 more minutes. Anything you want to throw in? If you want to plug the book or plug some appearance that you might be making, that's quite all right.
Well, one thing that I think that those who are listening would be interested in, because I've been again asked by literally hundreds of people in the last week or two when Don and I would be able to hold a so-called autograph party, book signing B, and we finally arranged to do this, and we're going to be at the university a week from tomorrow between 12 noon and 4 in the afternoon, and on the following day, that would be a week from Saturday, the 2nd of November, we will be at the Borealis bookstore in downtown Fairbanks from 1 o'clock to 5, and we'll be signing books. We're going down to Anchorage Saturday to the book cache, but the weekend following is going to be for Fairbanks, and I know there's a tremendous number of people. It's a very gratifying thing to know that people are interested in the book. That's the greatest reward of the whole book. The very fact that so many people seem to be interested. And I might mention one thing that I didn't learn until yesterday morning. I was called long distance from Chicago. Rand McNally, vice president, called me and informed me that they had run out of books. They have printed 11,000 books in the first printing, and in 2.5 weeks they were completely out. And this took them completely by surprise in Chicago. They are now scrambling furiously to get a second printing going, and I'm told it will just be a very short time, and they'll be printing many more than 11,000, I'm sure, the second time around. But the book has really taken off like wildfire, and as I say, beyond our wildest expectations. And the thing that really makes it all worthwhile for me is that people are interested in reading not only about Don Sheldon, but about Alaska and Alaskan aviation. And so that's the greatest reward.
One quick question. Did all those 11,000 copies come to Alaska? No.
There were, if I'm correct, now there's been a number of shipments. The first ones came by air freight. The dealers here paid the freight on them, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks. I believe in the neighborhood of 4,500 books either have come or are en route to Alaska. That is Anchorage, Fairbanks, and all of the outlying areas. And the balance of them were distributed down below.
So, Pam, the interest isn't confined to Alaska?
No, not at all. Alaska is, of course, a very current subject, and there's a tremendous amount of interest in the South 48 in Alaska, and so it seems to be reflecting in the book.
Don, we've got about 1 minute here. Have you got any parting comments for us, or words of wisdom you'd like to leave with the people?
I once heard a saying to all those that are interested in airplanes, you'll never get lost if you stay between the red and the green light.
Well, I hope anybody who's listening knows what that means. I'm not an aviator, and it went over my head. But thank you very much for being with us. It's been an enjoyable show, and we'd like to have you both back again sometime. Sean, that's Feline for this evening. Don Sheldon, a well-known Alaskan bush pilot. Our V-line number is 452-2468. If you have questions you'd like to ask our guests, you can call in and go right on the air with your questions, or you can give them to Sean and he'll pass it along to our guests. Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for waiting. Mr. Sheldon, we'll start right out with you. Why don't you give us a real brief background, where you were born and how you came to Alaska.
Well, I was actually born in Colorado, but I spent my younger part of my life up until the age of 17 in Wyoming. And then I embarked for the great land of Alaska. And this was 1938. You'll pardon my hoarse voice. I just returned to Wyoming for a family reunion after 36 years, and I outshouted myself. But I'm extremely pleased to be here. I have many friends throughout Alaska, and I've had the great privilege to fly the great skies of Alaska since 1941 and have covered all of the areas that a lot of you are familiar with.
What brought you to Alaska in the first place?
Well, Wyoming is a wonderful land, but it's a little slow. And my job, or one of my jobs, was to stack hay on my uncle's ranch. And this involved an old-fashioned haystacking rig. And my job was to drive the team that ran the stacker. And it also occasionally got several rattlesnakes tangled up with the hay load as it went up on the hay mound. And at that point, the hired farmhands would abandon the haystack. So there's many advantages and a few disadvantages living in Wyoming. It looked like at the time I wanted some greener horizon, and I came to Alaska, and I've been sitting on the edge of my seat and sharpening my teeth ever since.
Jim, why don't you give us a little background about yourself again, how you managed to get to Alaska?
Well, I was born and raised in Wisconsin and went to school at Michigan State University. And then, rather than draw the thing out in minute detail, I ended up in Rochester, New York, where I worked for the Rochester Museum of Arts and Sciences for a year and a half. And I had been in Alaska in 1959 and 1960 working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I liked it real well. I guess it was kind of a lifelong ambition of mine, really. I was kind of a classic example. Read a lot about Alaska and always wanted to come up here, and so I finally got the chance to when I got the job at the University Museum.
And how did you ever run into Mr. Sheldon?
Well, I'm not even too sure Don remembers this. It was a classic example of the soft sell. I have a boy who at that time was about 9 or 10 years old, and he had his birthday on around the 10th of June, and he's an avid trout fisherman. And so I had heard of Don in Talkeetna, and he came very highly recommended as a guy who knew where the trout lived. So I called him up unannounced, on the telephone, and told him I wanted to go and catch some trout. And he said, come on down anytime, and I guess this was late winter. And then I got busy, and one thing happened after another. It sort of slipped my mind, and one day I got my mail, and I was opening my mail, and here's a long envelope, said Talkeetna Air Service on the front of it. I opened it up, and inside there's a plain piece of yellow legal paper. And inside of the yellow legal paper is a beautiful picture of some of the biggest rainbow trout I've ever seen laying out on the lawn. And all that was written in marking pen on the yellow legal paper was, let's go fishing. And that did it, and I was down there on the 10th of June. I've been going down there every year since, and that's my boy's birthday present each spring.
How many years ago was that?
Well, I can't even remember the year. It was probably about 1965, I believe, 66, somewhere in that vicinity.
When did you decide that Don Sheldon was worth a book and decide to write one?
Well, I think it wasn't too long after I met him. I, of course, realized I had heard a lot about him, and I've always been interested in aviation, and had heard, as I say, a lot about Don and what he was doing down there. And after a period of a couple of years, after I saw with my own eyes what he was doing, I was very much aware that someday someone would write a book about him, because it was just almost inevitable. And that was probably a couple of years after I met him that I realized that. So,
what was your feeling, Don, when he suggested to you first that he wanted to write a book about you? What did you think of it?
Well, usually they get all the facts piled up, and there's been a tremendous amount of photographic and magazine coverage of certain areas of our operation. One of them is the high altitude glacier operation, which started in 1951 and continued to 59. Professor Brad Washburn, Boston Museum of Science, mapped the whole Alaska range, but first, at that time, he had to have a means to close the distance to get to the area of the major peaks of the Alaska range. And I happened to have 8 airplanes at the time, and hired 3 pilots and 1 ace mechanic, and I had a peculiar special type of an aircraft that he's very interested in. It was a new Super Cub with number serial -2 of the new retractable skis that were fresh off the drawing board in 1948. And he approached me several years later, that was in 1950, and he said that his plan was to map the great uncharted area of the Alaska Range. It had been high altitude photographed by the Air Force, but what they needed was some precise elevations, and the result after 9 years was a beautiful, accurate map, which was finally edited in Switzerland. But the thing was, one of the points was to close the distance to the high altitude glaciers, and in so doing, you had to have a means of conveyance. Well, this particular small aircraft I had was perfectly ideal for the job, and Professor Washburn was very anxious to get on with the project, and he said, I have an offer for you. We want to pay you $100 a landing, and we'll pick the area, and you pick the exact location. And with the down payments on these airplanes, these lineup of 8 aircraft, naturally I was ready to go. And surprisingly enough to him and everyone else, in the total 9-year survey, relaying all the survey crews that surveyed the whole Alaska range, I never damaged an aircraft. Not one of the aircraft after 9 years had a scratch or any damage from the high altitude survey. Now, one morning on the 3rd day of the survey, a beautiful bright March morning, you remember I said that the offer was $100 a landing in a new area. Well, he had all these survey crews ready to go, and I had them in a base staging area of the amphitheater, the beautiful southeast approach of McKinley, most spectacular view of the whole Alaska range. This was our starting point. We brought the levels from sea level clear up to the 6,000 foot level, and from here we would triangulate and go to the various peaks in all directions. Well, before 11 o'clock that morning, I'd made 8 landings. I made $800. And Professor Washburn called a halt, and he's pretty foxy. He said, let's rediscuss and renegotiate this $100 landing clause, because you're going to break the Boston Museum of Science and the National Geographic both. So his suggestion was that we make it $50 a landing and go back to our charter rate, which we did.
Thank you. And Jim, what is your particular interest in flying, and also what's your interest in being an author? I mean, how have you managed to combine the two?
Well, my interest in flying is, of course, much, much more casual than Don's. I fly for fun, and I truly enjoy it. It's probably the greatest thing I've ever learned to do. But I do not, of course, do it commercially as Don does, in any shade of the imagination. As far as my writing is concerned, I started out writing magazine articles, and I had never tackled a book, of course, before the book on Don, and it was a challenge, to say the very least, when I thought about it. And it just sort of grew on me. Once I started, why, it became something that I enjoyed very much. And the stories and words just began to mount up, and pretty soon we had about 102,000 words of manuscript.
Your title is Wager with the Wind. Does that have any special significance?
Well, yes, it does.
Look
on it.
Could I explain that?
Sure.
All right. All of the major catastrophes, not all, but a large percentage of aircraft accidents, climbing accidents, and disasters are directly related to the massive exchanges of storm areas over the various mountain ranges of Alaska. And when flying light aircraft, you must, in order to get the job done, lock horns with the elements to a certain degree. Now, the degree is several considerations. One is, as I see it, to safely, the primary purpose of flight is safety, deliver the goods safely. Now, this is easy to say and hard to do, because often you're forced into inclement conditions. Often you start out under ideal conditions, and you're suddenly enveloped in tremendous winds, rotor shear force winds. You're subject to the various cloud covers and formations. And so, Wager with the Wind met the approval of all, because it explained the situation of the problem. The problem being the main objective was blocked by the elements of nature.
Don, what does it take to be a really good pilot as opposed to just an average pilot? What is it about you that you think makes you such an outstanding pilot?
Well, I would rather say I just have more than my share of luck. Now, everyone that flies an airplane hopes to excel in a number of areas. When you're flying, as many of my friends are, commercially, you are not paid to make mistakes. You're paid to get the last ounce of performance from your aircraft. You're paid to make wise decisions, hopefully, and even the wisest decisions go aperless in a while due to combinations of weather and mechanical or intangible situations that overcome and have been a problem in Alaska because of our rapid change of various weather phenomena. Now, weather, from point A to point B, is simple to fly unless you get broadsided by a midair in the pattern, which happens occasionally. There's also the problem of mechanical. Now, one of the largest problems, according to accident reports, is the problem of pilot failure. The primary thing is to determine what you want to do with the aircraft, and then hopefully have a backup knowledge that will allow you to use the aircraft in such a manner as to accomplish your mission. Let me explain further. Suppose you, in the case of the Institute of Aquatic Biology, our base landing area was 14,300 feet on the west approach of McKinley. This was a space age study. It was a physiology at high altitude study. The University of Alaska, for three seasons, had an intensive program. They had their finest doctors, their experts on hypoxia, anoxia, and all the sciences and blood chemistry. They wanted to help determine for the space age exactly what took place of heavy exertion at high altitude. And they did this by staging Number one, the 14,300-foot level. Number two, the 17,200-foot level. Our base landing was at 14-3 on the west approach of McKinley. I had, in 1960, discovered a credible place to land up there if the conditions were right. At any rate, many things were learned about physiology at altitude.
Jim?
I'd like to interject just two things here. First of all, go back just for a moment to the tidal wager with the wind. Before we go by it too quickly, Roberta, Don's wife, is the gal who suggested the title, and it's a good one. I like it a lot, and I think she should get credit where credit is due. Also, I'd like to mention that in 1960, the landing that Don so casually talks about finding, or the area he talks about finding at 14,300 feet, was a record at that time, and it was a tremendous height to land at, and an extremely notable accomplishment. It was a fixed-wing aircraft record at that time. And what is the length, 1,700 feet of the strip you land on?
Right. If you abort the takeoff, it takes 8 men 3 hours, plus the driver in the airplane, because of the steepness of the incline, to get the airplane up to a takeoff position. If the snow is of a reasonable condition, sometimes you have to work on the runway for 8 or 10 hours in order to pack it to a suitable consistency to try a takeoff.
Let's talk about the book just a little bit. Jim, you want to say something first?
Just one last thing. Don, do you suppose you could just ever, I've been asked so many times over the last months what it's like to land, or what it was like when you first landed at 14,300 feet, the first time you tried it. Could you describe what the sensation was like?
Well, here's the, you must have a little background in the old Ace Air Force, just a minute. This is a half of the Earth's atmosphere is above 18,000. 14,300 requires a 15,000-foot coast. Therefore, you probably need oxygen unless you know otherwise. In my case, I'm fortunate I have a 21,000-foot oxygen, no oxygen tolerance. And I took oxygen with me, but I didn't need it for the primary landing to pick up an injured mountaineer at the 14.3 elevation. At any rate, to land, you must have light to determine the crevassing. Most of these places, no one ever took a good second hard look at, let alone contemplated landing at. There's hundreds of places in the Alaska range that I've scrutinized in bright sunlight and determined that I could land. There's an involved detail.